Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, we celebrate the lasting legacy of Lorraine Hansberry with J. Nicole Brooks, Natalie Y. Moore, and Erica Ratcliffe. The following conversation originally took place August 22nd, 2024, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum.
Hi, everybody. How are we doing tonight? Good. I'm Carrie Cranston, president of the American Writers Museum. Tonight's program will include a panel conversation, and if we have time, there will be an opportunity for Q&A with our panelists. But as a reminder for the people online and the people in the room, a question is normally 1 to 2 sentences, and it ends in a question mark.
I love that story. And
I want to thank you all for being here and for valuing the past, present, and future of American writing. I'm going to try and quickly go through our introductions tonight and explain what we're doing. Tonight, we will celebrate Lorraine Hansberry, a playwright who shaped the course of American theater and broke past huge barriers in her very tragically short life. While best known for her play Raisin in the Sun, she wrote in multiple forms and was a powerful voice for change in one of the most important eras of American history. Tonight's program is in partnership with the Lorraine Hansberry Initiative. The initiative was created by the Lilies, conceived by Lynn Nautaj and Julia Jordan, to honor Lorraine Hansberry's legacy through the tour and permanent placement of a figurative sculpture of the playwright while investing in those following in her footsteps through the creation of a fellowship which supports the living expenses of women and non-binary writers of color during their pursuit of graduate degrees. If you would like to thank or talk to Lynn and Julia, they are right over here. And we are so grateful that they have created this sculpture, taken it around the country, taken it to the world, and that it will now have a permanent home here in Chicago at Navy Pier in Polk Park. So, you know, we're thrilled to be having this important conversation tonight. And to have that conversation, we have three wonderful panelists with us. J. Nicole Brooks is an actor, author, and director. As a playwright, Brooks has created original works, including Black Diamond, The Years the Locusts Have Eaten, Phaedra, Queen of Haiti, Hela, Black Moon Lilith, and the award-winning Her Honor, Jane Byrne. Brooks has also served as director and associate director, mounting successful theater productions for Mr. Ricky Calls a Meeting, Thaddeus and Slocum, A Vaudeville Adventure, Her Honor Jane Byrne, Sex with Strangers, and Black Diamond, The Years the Locusts Have Eaten. Her television credits include recurring roles on Showtime's The Chi and Comedy Central's South Side. She is a multi-award-winning artist honored by 3 Arts, TCG Fox Foundation, National Endowment for the Arts, Black Ensemble Theater Playwright of the Year, LA Ovation, and Black Theater Alliance. She is an ensemble member of Looking Glass Theater Company. Thank you, J. Nicole, for being here. To my left, Natalie Moore is an award-winning journalist based in Chicago whose reporting tackles race, housing, economic development, food injustice, and violence. Natalie's acclaimed book, The South Side, A Portrait of Chicago and American Segregation, received the 2016 Chicago Review of Books Award for Nonfiction and was BuzzFeed's Best Fiction Book of 2016. She is the author of the play, The Billboard, set in Chicago. She is also co-author of The Almighty Black P. Stone Nation, The Rise, Fall, and Resurgence of an American Gang, and Deconstructing Tyrone, A New Look at Black Masculinity in the Hip Hop Generation. Thank you, Natalie, for being with us tonight.
Yes.
And to help lead our conversation, Erica Ratcliffe currently serves as the artistic director of Congo Square Theater Company, where she is dedicated to celebrating the complexities of Black life and culture on stage. Erica explores her artistry as a producer, director, and performer. Her directing credits include the critically acclaimed Chlorine Sky, White, and Welcome to Madison, and What to Send Up When It Goes Down at Congo Square Theater. As an actor, Erica has performed with various companies such as Goodman, Alliance Theater, Mixed Blood, Center Stage, Northlight Theater, and Chicago Shakespeare Theater, and Second City. She's an ensemble member with both Looking Glass Theater and Congo Square Theater. Erica is recipient of the Chicago 3 Arts Make a Wave Award and Art Equity's BIPOC Leadership Circle alumni. Her award, her contributions to the arts community continue to be driven by her passion for theater and a dedication to amplifying diverse voices. So please welcome our panelists for our discussion tonight.
Thank you, Carrie.
Oh, yes. Hi, everyone. There's that transition.
Grateful to be here. Grateful that so many of y'all have come out tonight. DNC be damned. We are here. Okay? That's what it's all about. And I'm so honored to be sitting here with two luminaries, Chicago luminaries. Just the way in which y'all uplift the art and all that you do. I'm so honored to be interviewing, leading this, moderating this conversation. So we're going to just kick it in the living room is what this should feel like, right? And so there's been a lot of honoring of Lorraine in the past year. I feel there's been lots of celebrations that have been going on. And just jumping off of the first question about when was the first time that you read or saw Raisin in the Sun? And what did that mean to you then? And then over time, what has it meant to you as a writer, as an artist? How has it influenced y'all?
I feel like I read Raisin in the Sun first, probably in high school. I don't have a memory of when that was. I went to school, college in DC. I remember seeing it at the Ford Theater. I don't know if that was my first time because I remember it felt very familiar. Like, it's just one of those plays that you know and you have read or seen multiple times that, at least for me, I can't tell you the first time, but those are two memories. I would say that I think you first learned about her like as this Black History luminary, but you know, I saw it at the Ford Theater because I was doing a story on it for the school newspaper. I remember asking someone was saying how timeless and how ahead of her time she was in the play. And I think whatever decade you watch it, that comes across. Mm-hmm. It is as relevant in 2024 as it was, you know, almost 60 years ago. And so that really, I think, says something about the enduring legacy. And then as I've, you know, gotten older about reporting, she grew to mean something different to me because of the story. You know, as a reporter who covers housing and segregation, when I was writing the South Side, I remember talking to a friend and saying, everybody knows that A Raisin in the Sun was based on her life. That's so obvious. Why should I put, like, no, I don't think people know that. Please don't gloss over that in the book. So I took that advice because I'm like, everybody knows about Lorraine Hansberry. And so, you know, knowing what Carl Hansberry did in 1937, knowing how, you know, she was 8 years old at the time, a brick almost missed her head when they moved into West Woodlawn. And then my grandparents were able to live in West Woodlawn because, I mean, we all know that the covenants were deemed unenforceable, not because of racial justice, but because not enough white people signed the petition to keep Black people out. So 500 homes opened up, and this was before covenants were, I mean, that case went up to the Supreme Court, and it paved the way for the 1948 case out of St. Louis to deem all covenants unenforceable. And then we had the Fair Housing Act of the St. Louis was Shelley versus Kramer, and then the 1968 Fair Housing Act. So knowing that, and then knowing that my grandparents, part of the Great Migration, were able to move there after World War II because of what the Hansberry did. So her work resonated with me on, you know, beyond the playwriting, but as this, you know, South Side girl who grew up and experienced this discrimination and watching her father, you know, I believe he died of racism because he had an aneurysm. Like, he was always suing the federal government for different egregious acts of racism. And I believe that that killed him.
Ooh, Ashe. Mm-hmm. Peace, y'all. It's good to be here. I'm with two humans that I rely on the daily. So this moment right here is real good for me. And I'm gonna take my time with it.
Yes.
I'm born and raised here. I'm born on the West Side. Hey, West Side, West Side, show yourself. And I'm raised on the South Side. Washington Park, show yourself. Hey, I see you. Come on, low end. South Side everywhere. South side. Southeast Side, we got you. All of Chicagoland, everybody, everybody. When I was about 11 years old, the way in for a lot of us that grew up just at the end of the Black Belt, right? So I grew up on Garfield and State. That's the main intersection. So that is the end of, at that time, that was the very end of where a long stretch of housing projects from Cermak, 22nd Street, all the way down to 55th, to the Boulevard, okay? I could roll call out so many housing projects. Matter of fact, I credit segregation with teaching me about so many of my Black heroes, because back then, all of our schools, at least where we were named after everybody Black. And at that time, Lorraine Hansberry did not have a school named after her, but at Carter School, where I went, 5740 South Michigan Avenue, that's where the Hansberry family, okay? We talking Hansberry Planet, right? But I didn't know that growing up. What I did know was to escape all of what I was escaping, was to just do the best I could. And if I did the best I could get the Scholastic School Fair. You know, the book fair?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Hey, all I wanted to do was get the Pizza Hut certificate for free pizza. If you kept your grades up, then you got to go to a book fair. And you got to go to the book fair and you got to select, you know? And it was there that I saw A Raisin in the Sun. And it was in... I grabbed it. I was like, wait a minute, this is what they show on Channel 9. And I flipped through it, and I'll never forget. There are pages from the production of the film. And the book doesn't really talk much about Lorraine Hansberry penning, being the screenwriter, but all I knew was this movie I'd seen a few times on Channel 9, and I liked, and Sidney Poitier was in it, and I liked him because, you know what I mean? Just like, so for me, it was like all the things.
Yeah.
And so that book, when I was 11 years old, taught me about screenwriting, and it taught me, it was the first play I ever read. Mm-hmm. So from the age of like 11 to 14, I kept that book, and I read it and reread it and reread it. Fast forward to now I'm at Northern Illinois University studying theater. And I'm in this program where it's predominantly white, and all I could do was escape to what I knew, and that was to the library. So I went to the library, and I was like, give me every Black playwright you can. And so then again, Sweet Lorraine came back with Young, Gifted, and Black. And so I studied Young, Gifted, and Black, which her husband had sort of, was like an anthology. And so from the time of 11 to about 21, Lorraine Hansberry was in my life big, big, big time. I mean, she's still there. I mean, right. You know what I mean? And it goes beyond, you know? So the to answer the question, it's like, I grew up on 55th. And like, I knew that the Hansberry family was in that vicinity. So when I think back to what the story is about, I'm like, well, she's definitely writing about, and oh my God, I know we're gonna go in there. But you know, that's not her only work, of course, right. But like, it just meant so much to me. So it's always stayed there for me. It's always been, the work of Lorraine Hansberry has always been a guiding light for me.
Mm-hmm. It's like a blueprint for so many of us, I think. That's great, y'all. Thank you for sharing that. And I'm gonna ask, just to piggyback off of that, there's so many of us that have been influenced by Hansberry's work, her exposure, her successes, being on Broadway and that way, and the many artists and playwrights that she opened the doors for, and the works that have been now since inspired. Some specifics are, you think about Clybourne Park or Beneath This Place by Kwame Kwame Amar, Genesis that Definition Theater did very early on, that was about the early part of Beneath This, that was after about Beneath This life after the play. So many plays that you think about that are inspired by Lorraine's work even now. And just what do you think is the greatest legacy of Hansberry in American theater? Like, it's a big one, but.
We're all right here together, that part, right? And I mean, like, I feel like her work is still, there's so much still left to unearth. Mm-hmm. We only have just started to know, I think, who Lorraine may have been. And so that question for me is a bit difficult to answer, because yes, while I've been like studying the clues and what is left behind for all these years, I still feel like, wow, I don't know this gifted, deeply complex, Black, queer human. Like, I still don't know.
Like you were saying, Natalie, that it's not everyone assumes that they know, or we assume that there's a knowledge about her upbringing, her life, her short life, unfortunately, but we don't. And so, but she's still so well known, so it's.
Yeah, I'll tell a story that is going to diss somebody in the process. I'm gonna get a little messy.
Right, tea time.
So if you haven't read Looking for Lorraine by Imani Perry, a wonderful book where we really understand that her life being cut off so short cut off so much brilliance, and that she was in this trifecta of James Baldwin and Nina Simone, and you know, really was this radical leftist who eschewed her, you know, I mean, bourgeoisie to a certain extent. You're still in segregated South Side, but you know, her, the Hansberry had money, more money than most Black folks in the Black Belt at the time. And that made her uncomfortable. And so just her journey of, you know, Marxism and leftists and traveling is such a story. And so I, you know, I love that book. So then there's another biography that was written by her. Actually, I don't even remember his name, so I can't even be messy, but you know, it's out there. It came out a few years ago. A white man wrote her biography. And he emailed me. Yeah. And it took everything. I had to like counsel, like, do I respond to this email? Do I respond to this email? I had just done this big project with NPR, a national project on racially restrictive covenants and how there's no clearinghouse for them. And, you know, to get, find them here, like there's no database. You have to like go into the bowels of the Cook County basement. And, you know, I found, I was living in Hyde Park at the time. I found out that my apartment was, I mean, not a surprise because everything was under one, but it's still something emotional to see where you live, that I couldn't have lived there unless I had been a domestic. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we did this huge project, different cities and talking about it. And so he was writing a biography and he wrote me to tell me how misguided I was. And how Carl Hansberry was a slumlord, and that covenants were not about race, and I was being disingenuous by saying that, because it was, people just want to live around people like them, like Polish people couldn't be. Now, mind you, they said no African blood in these covenants. They said, like, the language is there. I was not sugarcoating it.
Yeah.
And he was like, and I'm writing a biography of Lorraine Hansberry, and so. I don't even know how this could.
Yeah,
it relates because
is
here
he
on
here
one,
tonight.
No,
yourself.
He doesn't. He doesn't live here, and he's written biographies of other people. Like, I don't know what made him write about Lorraine Hansberry. He doesn't write about Black people. He's not a theater person.
He don't even
he's not
go
critical.
Here.
He don't even go here. But she would have been, I think, relating it back to what we don't know about her, what we're still unfolding about this radical life, that she would not have wanted this man to be writing about her or for him to be saying this was not about race. And so how do we protect and guard her legacy? And yes, we're all here gathered, and I'm so happy. Like, yes, DNC, be damned. I'm sure we can all go home. Like, we, the speech won't come on till midnight. We got hours and hours to go. But there's so much work. Like, I was in Croton on Hudson, where Lorraine Hansberry lived, and they do this festival, and they brought me to be their keynote speaker, and we made a pilgrimage to her grave. And like, this small group of folks who live in Hudson Valley every year uplift her and bring flowers to her grave and do some sort of programming. And we know that there are so few women statues, not only in Chicago, but in this country. And so we are saying her name by being here. And also tomorrow, you know, going to this event where, if you don't know her and all those tourists who come on Navy Pier, you're going to see. So that's, and there's probably no Black playwright, or very few, who can't, their story, the origin story may not be Lorraine Hansberry, but that influence, I think, just runs through and through somehow.
Oh, you know, I'm still ruminating on your first question. How does this still influence you today?
Yeah.
I mean, just again, I know everyone's like, everyone always talks about a raisin in the sun, but for me, it just kind of like it popcorned out so many things. So again, go back to when I'm an 11-year-old child, I'm rewatching this film every Saturday, and that's how I learned who Diana Sands was. That's, you know what I mean? And then that's where I remember one day I was watching it, and my mom was like, oh, look at little Glenn Thurman. I was like, wait, ooh, that's, yeah. Right?
Right?
And
right.
So the I'm like, wait, that's Preach from Cooley High? And so, like, you know.
You mean the colonel from Different World.
Right? But for me, that was like, because Cooley High was the other movie that I watched, like, all the time. But back to Diana Sands for just a moment. Diana Sands, because of this her relationship, of course, they were friends, she and Lorraine Hansberry. And she also died very young, tragically, of cancer. And there was a film that Diana Sands was supposed to star in called Claudine. Mm-hmm. And Claudine was, you all know it as Diane Carroll giving a gorgeous performance, but she did it because Diana Sands became sick with cancer and wasn't able to do it. So for me, Lorraine Hansberry opened up this portal, I suppose you could call it, for me as a very young person. And this is the influence that made me go, hey, I want to direct. Ooh, I want to write. Ooh, I want to act. What if I want to do all of them? I can. Mm-hmm. And it's because of the audacity of somebody that I've never met. And it's really, frankly, crazy to me. I mean, you can think whatever you want to about statues or not, but, like, my goodness. I think it is, I'm so grateful for this Lorraine Hansberry initiative and what we're doing. And shout out to the Lilies. I mean, I think it is absolutely that Black femme writers and women are just still under-recognized. So the influence is like, yeah, it's here. And I just love the way it's spreading. But if you have grown up in hyper-segregation, like so many of us have, that is also a question to me that's like, well, I don't know. Why, like, you know, I'm so used to it.
Yeah.
And it's in my work.
Right.
So
right.
That's the influence.
You were just talking about just her being basically a bold, radical feminist before people talked about that, before that was even a thing. That was a term that I think was used in the 50s regarding her. And she said one time, twice oppressed may become twice militant. Yes. And how do you see her work, just piggybacking off what you said, and how it influences women, femme writers, especially. I just love that quote too.
I do too.
You know,
say it again.
Twice oppressed may become twice militant.
All I hear is be stealth. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's all I heard from the years of reading her work. You know, to me, when I think about so many of the works of Lorraine, I call her stealth because she just sort of moves throughout. So whereas people think that she's only talking about one thing, she was able to definitely move through so many circles. And yes, of course, I wish that her life expectancy were longer so that we could have seen more of her work. And I'm sure that she wanted to work on the shows that she was able to get produced more. I'm not sure how to answer that question, Erica.
What about you now?
I mean, I think we see her the most in Beneatha. Mm-hmm. Like, that is, you know, no, why should I get married? Why should I do this? I'm going to, like, the, I wouldn't, I mean, considered oddball then, but this young woman who was asserting herself with education and the freedom to date who she wanted and not be confined by familial or society's expectations. So I think that we were really seeing, and again, when we talk about, you know, icons and Black History Month, like we don't really, we think of, for example, Rosa Parks as this matronly gray-haired woman who didn't feel like getting up and like the radical, like the anti-rape work that she was doing. Or that this was, I mean, as a kid, I thought it was like, oh, she just didn't feel like getting up that day. Like, it was organized. And so we kind of sanitize. And with Lorraine, we don't know her backstory, which is why I felt like Imani Perry's work was so important. And not just the biography, but situating her with, like, we're understanding, we all know about James Baldwin because, well, he didn't live the longest, but I don't know if it's a gendered thing. But when I saw that documentary on Nina Simone from a few, I was blown away. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know just how radical and angry she was. And so I think there's something kind of sanitized about our hero. Like we just look at them and the first to do this, they did this thing, but we don't get into their interior lives.
Yeah.
And but we did that with Baldwin, but not with the two of them. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, putting them to get like, no, these three were a force and it wasn't just Baldwin. And I think that's the story that needs to, and more work. I mean, even, you know, I emailed Imani after that fool emailed me and she was like, don't respond to him. Don't respond to him. She's like, you don't understand how angry I am that he is doing the work. And it wasn't because she felt like she was the only voice. Like, we can do, like, she was, like, this is just one biography. There's more to say. So it's not about being the only one to comment on our luminaries or to write about them.
Right.
You know, there's a, gosh, I wish I had it. I came across a book in a, you know, old bookstore, and gosh, it was a photo journalist sort of book during the civil rights era. And there was a conversation between JFK.
This is real?
Yeah, because it was, I saw the Lorraine Hansberry and James Baldwin. And there was private correspondence on them. And I'm gonna find this book again, but like, I was like, they were all in the same room. To your point, like we have the sanitized view and don't really know. Like I had the same experience when I saw, are you talking about the documentary, What's Wrong, Miss Simone? I think that's the title.
It had a question mark in it.
Right, yeah. What's the matter, Miss Simone, or whatever it is, excuse me. I was blown away by it too. I had the same sort of, I was like, well, I thought I had a clue. You could tell in her music, but I had no clue. I can't imagine that Lorraine didn't have that same fire.
Right. Yeah. I mean, all of Nina's work, when you listen to it,
yeah,
to get her there to share those stories through song, I mean, the pain and that you talk about Lorraine's father, you know, the battles and the struggles and the demons she fought were powerful.
I think, until her last day. So, yeah. Can I ask you about your influence of Her Honor, your amazing play, your amazing dedication to Chicago? And just, I mean, how it, you talk about just how she influenced you and since you were 11 and it, and I feel like that shows up in your work. It shows up in that play in a really big way. And so can you just speak about that, or it was just in those stories that celebrate Chicago and point out the racism in the city through the lens of like just the experience?
Thank you. I'd be mad. And it comes out. I'm mad. I'm mad because I can't understand why my family, who's lived in Washington Park since 1980, is still a food desert. There is not a grocery store to be found. It's 2024, you feel me?
Yeah.
So as not to jump out on everybody, I try to take a pause, take a deep breath, and examine and investigate what is around me. Mm-hmm. So often, a lot of my writing has to do with my environment and the history of it. So in my play 1919, which is based on the beautiful poetry of Dr. Eve Ewing about the Chicago 1919 race riots,
yeah.
It's Chicago at its core, mm-hmm. to have to learn about these horrible, ugly things. You absolutely have to look at it. You absolutely have to examine it. I wasn't able to really write Her Honor Jane Byrne, which looks at the 3 weeks in which a Chicago mayor in 1981 moved or took residency in the Cabrini-Green housing projects. And I want to give a loving shout out to the Byrne family. Her daughter, Kathy Byrne, recently passed away. And Kathy Byrne was one of the most incredible and supportive people to me personally. It's not easy when you're writing about people and they're no longer here to defend themselves or explain themselves or simply say, I don't want you to write about me, or please write about me. So you're often dealing with their children or whomever is left. And for me, I didn't want to, you know, I don't want to crush nobody. I don't want to crush nobody's mama, but I'm also going to keep it real.
Right.
I'm also going to talk about how difficult and complicated it is for a white mayor to move into a black housing project, and it is sensationalized. And was it actually real, or was it a stunt? So like all of these things I examine in my plays. And I think it's because I love Chicago. I love examining history, good, bad, and ugly. How old is this city? I don't know, like 4.5 billion years old, if you take it back. And we got a lot of stories. So I just like to dig and see what is there. And again, I learned that from Lorraine Hansberry.
Is it healing for you?
Yes.
Can you talk about that? Like it your is. Writing and how it helps you to like, to be a balm for you as a as an artist, as a human living in this life?
So when I was writing 1919, again, it was based on a book of poetry, but that book of poetry was, and also my work of the adaptation was based on a nearly 800-page document about the Chicago 1919 race riots.
Yeah, that is more than 800
pages. It's more than 800, right? It is more than 800. So when you read through it, it's intense. You're reading through coroner reports. You're reading through everything. I could only go so far.
Yeah.
That pain, mm. just Eugene Williams.
Mm.
Ashe, may you rest in power. Eugene Williams was the child, a young black swimmer, 17 years old, minding his own business that hot summer day when he crossed a racial line and was stoned to death as a result. And that is what kicked off the Chicago 1919 race riots. So to answer your question, Wheezy, we homies for real in real life, okay? You ask if it's healing. How is it healing to look at a report, right? Mm-hmm. But at the core of revolution is joy. So for me, the healing comes with dark humor. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to take all of the facts and I'm going to put it right back in your face.
Yeah.
That's how, so for me, laughter, a deep, wicked sense of humor, I think is how I get through it. And that's what's healing. But I don't shy away from the ugly. And I try to really put it all in my work so that even if one person learns one thing and that gives them a sense of investigation, that is my only goal as a writer. It is not for you to walk away from a production of mine and think, oh my God, that's the best thing I ever saw. If you can walk away and go, I need to find out a little bit more about X, Y, and Z, then for me, mission accomplished.
Yeah.
And that is healing for me personally.
Yeah.
You do the same thing.
Is the same for you with... Well, you know, with Southside, that's a different medium of writing. And but so was that healing for you or the exposure of all of these things that folks may not know?
For me as a writer, an interdisciplinary writer, it's about telling people stories that matter, people being able to see themselves writing for people, not about them. And so with, you know, whether it's daily journalism or a book or a play, you know, some are more lasting, like some, okay, you heard that story, boom, it's gone. A book you can put on your shelf, a play may last longer with you. But, you know, I co-wrote an audio docudrama about the 1919 race riots with Make Believe Association that aired on, it was a podcast and aired on BZ. And it was the, like for me, the moment was that report was written, and we never said this explicitly because it's more difference between like journalism and entertainment, like how you tell the story to reach people. That report said, do not segregate Chicago. And the city did the exact opposite. And so how do you unfold that story, unfold that narrative? And you know, like, I mean, I guess I should say, you know, quickly too, I saw Black Diamond and did not know her. And I was like, I want to be her friend. And I found her on Twitter. This is like 2006.
Twitter?
We're Twitter friends. Like, we met on Twitter.
Shout out to the OGs.
You must have been the first person on Twitter.
Okay, yes, we are.
You know, before it became...
Beloved hell site.
Yeah, I mean, I can't get off, but...
nor can I. And I was a huge fan of this one. So, like, it was... I'm so glad we found our way to each other.
Yeah, so I didn't, like, stalk her, but we just started... sit. And then, you know, with Erica, I had just moved back to Chicago in 2006, so I saw that. I saw Stickfly. I didn't know Erica, and I was like, I want to be my friend. Like, it took a little longer for her to be my friend, because, I didn't have any...
I wasn't on Twitter.
To try to. And, you know, then last year, I mean, Lydia Diamond wrote that. And then I got the Lydia Diamond Playwriting Award for like Black Woman Over 40.
Yes.
A small niche here in Chicago.
Shout out.
And so, you know, finding different ways to tell stories. And, I mean, there's an expression, get somebody who loves you the way Chicago people love Chicago.
Mm.
And through that love is critique, it's the same thing. So whether it's that Covenant story or even the billboard about a book, like there's certain themes that stay in. And I think housing is the through line for me, housing segregation. You know, the billboard was set in Inglewood. Do they talk about housing directly? No, but the disinvestment of the community. And then, you know, the new play I've been working on called Back Home that's set in South Shore during the housing crash. And it's about, you know, Black legacy of community, but also institutions. Yes. And these are things that I have seen flounder in my own community. I still live on the South Side. So it's, I don't know if healing is the word, but it's educating, but not in a pedantic way. It is trying to meet people where they are in the, you know, all art to me should be political, like art is politics. And then journalism is, and you know, and
there's a lot of synergy there because you're writing in audio, I'm writing for the ear, and plays you're writing for the ear. So there was, and then my first, I was like, let me take a class. I don't be stupid trying to write this. And then at Chicago Dramatists, they had us read Ruin by Lynn Nottage. I had seen her work, but reading it, like reading plays is a different experience. And even the NPR training says, your script should be like a three-act play. And so that, you know, all of that, you know, comes together, and then trying to tell, yeah, just reach different audiences. But it's all about like loving and critiquing Chicago.
That's the only way I think we can love this city. Like, if you truly, if I feel like if you consider yourself to be a steward of this city, you really do have to uncover as much as you can. And I just want to give a big salute to you, because you're this person right here. If y'all don't know her work, get it together. Because if you want to hear it on NPR, you can hear it on NPR. If you want to read her published plays, you can. It is such an incredible resource, valuable to have a strong voice of the South Side.
Yeah.
Like, Natalie is so deeply connected to Chicago. Most of the time I get mad. I'm like, I hate it, it stank, and I don't like it. But like when I need to like come back to it, I'll text her, I'll be like, sis, where should I go for dinner? And she will give me 7 different choices. And they are all places that I know care about the community.
Yeah.
And that, all jokes aside, y'all know that that is a rare thing. How do I heal is trying to figure out, how do we have this kind of crowd on the West Side? Mm-hmm. How do we have this kind of crowd south of 55th? You feel me? How do we have this crowd on the Southeast Side? Like, we got work to do.
Y'all write love letters, and I was in Black Diamond, y'all.
I was trying not to just
be like, I forgot.
Okay, so just so, just real super quick, Black Diamond is a play way back in the year of our Lord, 2007, at Looking Glass Theater Company. We produced a play called Black Diamond, The Years the Locusts Have Eaten. I wrote it, and it was based on a group of soldiers, female soldiers in Liberia who had endured a horrible civil war. The play dealt with rape and child soldiers and so many things that the horrors of war will bring about. Erica was an actor in this show, and she was just incredible. And we did so much work together and research together. Yeah. And so, like, I would throw that same question back to you of how do you heal when you're dealing with all of this, you know?
I mean, it's the art. Mm. It's really, I remember when I was cast in that play, I was like, this is the blessing of all blessings. And I had just graduated. I was just getting in these streets and working with Nikki, working with the cast. It was, I mean, those folks became some of my best friends.
Can we shout out to some of them?
Yeah, shout them out.
Alana Arenas. Yeah. I mean, my
Tamberla
gosh.
Tamberla Perry. Kevin Douglas.
Yes.
Penelope Walker.
Yes.
Chicago.
Looking Glass Theater Company had not had that many Black people on stage ever. And so we just changed the racial ecology of the whole situation.
But that
and
play,
it was great.
That play, Slick, I don't think you really know this, but that I did that play and I said, I don't have to do nothing else ever again. Like, it fed me so much as an artist. And I was like, this is what art can do. It can heal audiences. It can heal artists. I learned so much about what was happening in other parts of the world in a way that connected me to that. I just love that you take history and you open it up for us to understand. Yeah, that play changed my life. It really did. Yeah. So, and we still out here healing from it. So,
Ashe.
I'm going to ask a, this one might be, this is a writer question. And so in 1964, in a journal entry that Lorraine recounted, that the struggle to write, I sit at this desk for hours and hours, sharpening pencils and smoking cigarettes, and switch from play to play, and nothing happens. I begin to think more and more of doing something else with my life. While I am still young, I mean almost anything, driving an ambulance or running a ski lodge, anything but this endless struggle. I expect the theater will kill me. Mm. And so as playwrights, how does this make you feel? And how do you relate to that? And more so, like, what is more painful about writing for the stage than, say, writing in other mediums? What's more open there? And then do you think it's harder for us as Black women, as playwrights, and telling those stories?
So as a journalist, you write a story, and inevitably an editor says, well, do you have someone saying, blah, blah, like, no one said that. When you're writing a play, a dramaturg says, well, if you said this on page 65, on page 25, the person needs to say this. It's like, okay, I can do that. Yeah. You're not, because I can make, you know, I mentioned that there were parallels. I do not fabricate my journalism.
Great.
Should have said that. But there's some freedom there about imagination that I can't do in nonfiction.
Yeah.
So that can be a little freeing. But I will also say playwriting is, I remember asking Nick, she was like, some plays are taking years, some plays take a couple of months. Like, it just depends on how the story is feeding you, what you want to. And for me, doing the first play was not about, like, I didn't know I was going to want to write plays. I just felt, often as a storyteller, I feel like I'm a midwife. Mm-hmm. And I was like, this story is a play,
yeah,
not something. My agent was like, write it. I was like, nope, I am not able to write the great American novel. I know my limitations. I was like, this is a play. It's not a novel. So there's freedom there. The hard side for me has been, and not just me, but it's way easier to get published as a nonfiction book than to get a play done. Like, it's such a commitment. It's, you know, it's a production, because it's not even yours anymore when it's on the stage. And just, we were talking about Beyonce earlier, in the Billboard, there's a scene where the doctor comes in and she's listening to Beyonce, and a friend texts me, she was like, I can't believe you put Beyonce in your play, you don't like her. I was like, girl, that was the director. Like, that's not my play anymore once it's on the stage. Mm-hmm. And that's not a bad thing. Like, it's, you have to relinquish control as a playwright. And I was comfortable. I know that some playwrights, like, are sitting there the whole time doing rehearsal. And I was like, this isn't, like, I'm okay with releasing it. But it's also such a commitment. Like, you have to get someone to invest in it and to, hey, it's not a book. So that has been, I would say, pretty sobering. And then quickly I'll say, you know, my own naivete was, so the Billboard came out the day Roe fell. And I kept telling the theater, the company, I was like, this Roe, no one believed me, because not because I thought I was a liar, but no one was used to rights being taken away. And when I saw Dobbs on the docket in December, I knew that court was going to overturn it. So I thought, well, not that my play is so great, but everybody's going to want to do this play because it's the zeitgeist. It's the moment. Right. Well, that did not happen. And I mean, I was even told, oh, this is too political. Like, what is the audience? So the tension between what an audience wants and the donors. And then I'll just say very quickly, my stepdaughter goes to Jacksonville University, and we went to go see her in the play The Women, which is set in 17th century France during the French Revolution. And I forgot the playwright's name, but this playwright is the most done playwright. And she's a woman, a white woman. Thank you, Lauren Gunderson. And, you know, I enjoyed the play very much. No. What'd you say?
I was going to say Lynn.
Oh, no, it was that is what I read. And it came to me. It was like, oh, you can do a radical feminist play that was set centuries ago. That's why. And so
the radical plays, and I'm using radical very loosely, but the plays that are political or of the moment, society isn't ready for right now, and a lot of, or theaters aren't ready to take that risk. And that's not just about me, but 100 years from now, 200 years from now, oh, maybe they'll be eating these plays up. But but I was like, oh, y'all really, and that it is, and The Women was great. That is not any shade at all to that writer, but it's more comfortable. Just like when we see injustices now, what would we do? Like, we can look and say, how could they let that happen 50 years ago, 100 years ago? Like, what are, and just like our great-grandchildren and so forth will look at this moment and say, how did they let these things happen?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm currently, like, when someone says, what are you working on? The first response is me, right? I'm trying to get my mind right, because it really does feel, for me as a writer, when it's full, it's real hard for me to do this.
Yeah.
So I feel like I've been on this journey of repair.
Yeah.
And so I've like been running, and I learned how to swim, and it's helping me just go a little bit more like this. So I'm currently writing this play about a former Chicago mayor, Harold Washington. May he rest peacefully. And I've talked to Natalie about some of this. When you are writing about someone that is so big and means so much to so many people, as the writer, it kind of makes you shrink, because you're like, yeah, that's great. Yep, okay. Yeah, I'm gonna write about that. I'm gonna take all of your notes. And and you feel like, ah, there's no way forth. I've talked to one of my colleagues and best friends right here, Lillian Brown, about it. Like, how do we go forth and just tell our, like, my, what is the story that I'm interested in? And I'm like, I don't know. Okay, this is what I do know. Writing does require discipline. It's the same thing as when I'm running. And so for me, I said, well, let's see if the two can come together. And when I kind of lean back and think about Harold Washington, I think this brother passed away tragically at his desk. Heart attack is what it, he was working so many hours. He was doing so many things. What was it like for his body? The policing of the body. Think about the pressure and stress, the like cortisol that must have been flowing through that man, and everybody like must have been flowing through their veins like crazy. So I take that, and that goes into my writing. I try, because from as far as my own impression, I didn't know Harold Washington. I was definitely a child when he was in his reign, but like it seemed like to me a lot of people were policing his body. He had to be black in this arena. He couldn't be too black here. Maybe he was queer. What is he doing messing around, giving queer rights? Okay, well, he's, you know, a shining black example of this, and you know, he's working 74 hours. What did that do to his body? So when I sit at the desk, sometimes that blank screen is real. And I don't know how to get through it, but I just go in little bitty bits. As it comes to me, it downloads. And like I told you, sometimes it downloads and you're like, yeah, I wrote that play in like 3 months, you know? And then there are times like now where I'm like, dang, I didn't have these books for 5 years. But then one day it comes together. Mm-hmm. It just does. And so I think it's up to the writer to stay conditioned. And I have to really take care of my mental health and not go to dealing with an industry that still has not come back from a double strike, dealing with an American theater. Shout out to SAG-AFTRA. Okay, if you're in the building, it's been tough.
hold on, hold on. Same thing with the writers, you know, and then that affects theater. You know, folks can't do those 6 and 7 and 8 theater plays per season. You know, it's like you got 2 shows that people can do. And then if it's too political, so there's a whole lot going on, and I'm just trying to hold on. And you just have to keep writing. You just have to like not let any of that stop you. And if it does, that's okay too. You get back up when it's time for you to get back up. And if you decide to drive an ambulance, then that's what it is, you know. There it is. Life is beautiful. You can tell stories any way you wish. And that's where I am. And that's my response to your question.
Yes.
And thank you all for this wonderful discussion. And thank you all for coming out tonight.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.